Chapter 4. The Big Short. Grown men were crying. One by one, the bankers poured onto Wall Street in dishevelled suits, heads down, holding their sad little cardboard boxes. Lehman Brothers was bankrupt. It was September 2008. The housing market just collapsed and the banks were going up in flames. The entire global economy was falling, like a house of cards. And it was the banks' fault. You know what? I'm pissed off. American people are getting screwed by the big banks, and I'm getting madder and madder. Michael Baum, The Big Short. I saw it happen to my own family. I watched them lose their homes. In 2007, my mother owned several properties and ended up going through bankruptcy. The banks were selling her these ridiculous jumbo loans that were way bigger than she could pay back. It just ran away from her and spiraled out of control. My aunt and uncle defaulted on their mortgage. I mean, this is as close to home as I can tell you. I was desperately trying to help my family out, help pay their mortgages where I could, trying to help people from being blown out. This is why I'm so convicted on Bitcoin. I watched the traditional banking system ruin my own family. From that period onwards, I knew there had to be an alternative. We just couldn't do that to people again. It was just like the Big Short movie. You know the scene where the stripper owns 5 homes and a condo on the beach, all with sketchy mortgages? My family was living it. And this wasn't their fault. Banks and lenders were handing out way too many risky mortgages to people who couldn't afford them. The snake oil mortgage broker in The Big Short summed it up. My firm offers ninja loans. No income, no job. I just leave the income section blank if I want. Corporate doesn't care. These people just want homes, you know. And they just go with the flow. I was a bartender. Now I own a boat. Oh, and I had one of these snake oil ninja broker guys in my family too. My cousin got into the mortgage business with no background at all. The guy bought a Mercedes and a new house, just flipping mortgages. Nobody had to verify their income. They were giving out mortgages as fast as they could. No experience. They just set up mortgage shops, flipped the contracts out, got their compensation. They didn't care one bit about the fact they were selling toxic paper to people without the ability to pay them. And it wasn't even the broker's fault. It was the big banks. This whole time, Wall Street was hounding these brokers and buying all the toxic mortgages they were selling. If I write a loan on Friday afternoon, big bank will buy it by Monday lunch. Big Short mortgage broker. Here's how it worked. The banks packaged these mortgages into bonds and sold them to pension funds and investors. They started out as high-quality investments full of solid mortgages. Your original mortgage bond was simple. Thousands of AAA mortgages bundled together, guaranteed by the US government. But the modern ones are different. When they ran out of high-quality mortgages to put in the bond, they started adding layers of risky subprime mortgages, like the ones they sold my family. Somewhere along the line, these went from a little risky to dog shit. And then Wall Street got even greedier. They started slicing and dicing the bonds up into an even riskier investment called CDOs. So the mortgage brokers are dog shit, but the CDOs are dog shit wrapped in garbage? Michael Baum, The Big Short. These things got so complicated that the banks didn't even know who owned the properties. When my aunt and uncle defaulted on their house, they carried on living there for a year without paying. The banks literally couldn't even figure out who owned the paper. The loan had been chopped up and sold on so many times. The banks gobbled up these CDOs and a whole alphabet soup of bullshit investments. Wall Street made a killing selling them to unsuspecting investors, and almost no one noticed because bonds are boring as hell. Pretty soon, stocks and savings were almost inconsequential to the big banks. They were doing 50, 100, 200 billion in mortgage bonds every year. The Big Short voiceover. But when people could no longer pay those sketchy mortgages, the Jenga tower started to fall. Behind the scenes, the Federal Reserve was slowly raising interest rates. Monthly mortgage repayments went up. People were already scraping up to pay their mortgages. Now they flat out couldn't afford them. Defaults started rising. When the default rate tipped over a certain threshold, all those dogshit mortgage bonds failed. By 2008, the whole thing came crashing down, and it wiped out the entire economy, like a tsunami. 3 million homes in America were foreclosed on. Unemployment doubled. Young people got punched in the gut. Many graduated into a decimated jobs market, forced to move back home with their parents. They watched their family lose their jobs, their homes. It was brutal. And you wonder why millennials are skeptical of the banks. The banking system was exposed as a failed, greedy, rigged system. And then they all got bailed out with our money. A month later, Bitcoin was born. Long Bitcoin, short the bankers. Just a month after the Lehman Brothers collapse, someone with the username Satoshi Nakamoto logged into an obscure cryptography mailing list and wrote publicly for the first time. I've been working on a new electronic cash system that's fully peer-to-peer with no trusted third party. The timing is not a coincidence. Bitcoin emerged from the ashes of a broken banking system, a new digital form of money that operated outside of the banks, governments, and any other third party. A truly global and open currency. A revolution against everything that caused the 2008 collapse. And just in case you still think it's a coincidence, Satoshi Nakamoto left us a message inscribed in the first ever Bitcoin block. The Times, 3rd of January 2009. Chancellor on brink of second bailout for banks. You could argue it's just a timestamp to prove he mined the first block on January 3rd, but the message is pretty obvious. Bitcoin is here as a screw you to the traditional banking system. A new form of money designed to cut out the banks. The money in your bank is not your money. Here's the worst part about the 2008 crisis. The banks created this entire mess by using your money. People don't realize this. When you deposit your savings at Bank of America or Citi, the bank takes that money and loans it out to other banks, and those banks loan it out again and again. Think about how much money is in your savings account right now. To keep it simple, let's say it's $1,000. That money doesn't actually exist at your bank. There's no vault with your name on it and a stack of notes inside. The bank is only required to keep around 10% of your money in its reserves. That's $100. They take the other $900 and loan it out to another bank. That bank keeps 10% in reserve and loans out the remaining $810 to another. And on and on and on. If we all went to the bank right now and demanded all our money back, they literally couldn't give it to us. There's only 10% there. This is fractional reserve banking, and it's why the banks nearly blew up in 2008. They lent out your money to risky borrowers, inflating the biggest credit bubble in history, and then it burst when no one could pay it back. Satoshi knew exactly what was going on. In one early conversation, when describing Bitcoin, he said, "Banks must be trusted to hold our money and transfer it electronically, but they lend it out in waves of credit bubbles with barely a fraction in reserve. Like I said, they're fucking with your money." Satoshi wanted to take that power away from the banks, so he created an ingenious system. Bitcoin is magical internet money. We joke about it, but Bitcoin really is magical internet money. Bitcoin wasn't the first internet currency, it's just the first one that actually worked. Geeks and cryptographers had been trying to invent digital currency since the internet was born, but they all failed because of one thing, the double spend problem. Here's Harold and his purple crayon to explain. Harold explains the double spend problem. Harold draws a computer. Then he draws an MP3 music file, CREAM by Wu-Tang, because who doesn't like Wu-Tang? Harold wants to send the song to his friend Sarah, so he draws up an email, attaches the MP3 file, and sends it to Sarah. What actually happens here? The file duplicates. The MP3 file doesn't actually leave Harold's computer. It's replicated. Harold still has the song on his computer, and now Sarah owns it too. You can't have a digital currency like this. If money worked in the same way, Harold would send Sarah $5, but he'd still have the duplicate $5 on his computer too. Harold could spend it twice, hence the double spend problem. He'd basically be printing money. Normally, this problem is solved by the bank. Harold draws a bank. Then he draws the bank manager. The bank manager has access to all the accounts for its customers. This is called a centralized system. Only the bank manager can see Harold's money and move it around. If Harold wants to send $5 to Sarah, the bank manager removes $5 from Harold's account and credits it to Sarah's account. But what if the bank is shady and starts moving the money to different places? This is exactly what they do, as we discovered. Satoshi Nakamoto wanted to cut out this shady third party, cut out any central authority. The problem in all of these systems is that you have to trust someone or some company to do the right thing with your money, and they rarely do. But who would verify Harold's $5 transfer if there's no one in charge? Satoshi finally figured it out. Everyone could verify it. Imagine if the bank spreadsheet was public. What if everyone could see it? That's effectively what Satoshi did. He gave everyone access to the spreadsheet of accounts and transactions, like a shared Google Doc. All of a sudden, everyone can see all the transactions and make updates in real time. The spreadsheet no longer exists in a central place. It exists on millions of computers all at once, open to anyone. It's decentralized. By the way, this means every transaction is visible on the Bitcoin blockchain. It's not anonymous, as many people think. Your name and personal details are all obscured by cryptographic code, but I can still see the flow of BTC, preserved forever on the blockchain. This time, Harold wants to send 5 BTC to Sarah. He suddenly got really rich. Harold sends the Bitcoin from his wallet to Sarah, and the transaction pops up on the big Bitcoin spreadsheet. This time, there's no single banker checking the transaction. Hundreds and thousands of people are checking the transaction right there in the spreadsheet. I'm one of them. My computing rig at the energy plant is verifying Bitcoin transactions all day long. Does Harold have enough money in his wallet? Yes. Okay, approve the transaction. But Harold is sneaky. He tries to send another 5 BTC to someone else right afterwards. This time, everyone can see that Harold doesn't have 5 BTC, so they refuse to verify it. Again, no one can fuck with your money with Bitcoin. If anyone tried something shady, thousands of computers would notice and refuse the transaction. This is robbery. If you need another example of why the money in your bank account is not really yours, ask the people in Cyprus. Their government literally stole the money out of their bank accounts overnight. In March 2013, a protest broke out in front of the Bank of Cyprus. Families were terrified, banging on the bank's windows, desperate to get their money out. One man showed up with a bulldozer, threatening to break through the glass doors. Days earlier, rumors began to swell that the Cypriot government was considering a one-time tax on bank deposits, a bail-in that would take money right out of their account. Cyprus never really recovered from the 2008 crisis and desperately needed to come up with 7.5 billion euros as part of a bailout package. If they didn't, the island's banking system would go bust. This was their only option. And then the announcement came. Wealthy savers at the main Cypriot banks would get 47.5% of everything over 100,000 euros confiscated. Roughly 4 billion euros was snatched from the Bank of Cyprus accounts overnight. They were replaced with worthless shares in the bank itself. Another 3.4 billion euros was swiped from depositors at Laiki Bank, the second largest in Cyprus. The government literally took money out of people's bank accounts to fund its own debt. Just think about how crazy that is for a minute. You wake up one morning, check your bank balance, and your savings have been taken away. A British expat who moved to the island to retire told the BBC it was pure robbery. "We retire and bring our savings to a bank in Cyprus, and they can just take our money away without permission, and then say we have shares in a bankrupt bank." I'll say it again. The money in your bank is not yours. It can be confiscated overnight if the bank or the government needs it. They can take your money to pay back their debts. Even when the Cyprus banks did open, there were new rules. Limits on credit card transactions, daily withdrawal limits, no more 300 euros cash per day, restrictions on sending money overseas. If you want to transfer 5,000 euros, you need permission from the central bank. This is not some rogue state or dictatorship. This is a European Union country telling you that you need permission to move your own money. The price of Bitcoin soared when this happened. At the beginning of the Cyprus crisis, BTC was trading at $47. It hit $88 by the end. Trading volume at Bitcoin exchange Mt. Gox almost trebled in the space of a few weeks. Cypriots were desperate to move their money into something that couldn't be confiscated by their government. something that was outside the crippled banking system. It was Bitcoin's first real-world test, and it worked exactly as designed. A parallel financial system outside the broken fractional reserve banks. When people needed it most, they finally had an alternative. Bitcoin was there for them. It was a breakthrough moment. I know some of you reading this will be thinking, that would never happen in America. It could. In 2010, right after the banking crisis, Congress passed the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Act. It introduced a new safety net for the banks. It's called statutory bail-ins. If there's another crisis, the banks are now allowed to use your money to restructure themselves. In normal language, that's a Cyprus bail-in. The bank can take money out of your account to rescue themselves. Shah Gilani, former hedge fund manager, wrote a piece called Why I'm Closing My Bank Accounts While I Still Can, where he explained what's going on. It is entirely possible in the next banking crisis that depositors in giant too-big-to-fail banks could have their money confiscated and turned into equity shares to try and keep the bank from failing. Even today, the biggest US banks owe hundreds of trillions of dollars in derivatives, just like the ones that caused the 2007 collapse. According to the legislation, if the banks go bust, those debts get paid before we do, and they can take the money from your account to pay it. So, yeah, it could happen. Anyway, back to 2008. After the banking collapse was when America really started firing up the money printer. This was the moment of no return. They switched it on in 2008, and they'll never turn it off. Back to the 2008 bailout. We need $700 billion and we need it in 3 days. Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke. With Wall Street on fire, they needed a way to put it out. They needed to stop the banks blowing up, and the only option was a bailout. The US government would have to buy all the toxic mortgages from the banks, and taxpayers would have to foot the bill. Get them off the balance sheet, whatever the cost. Panic was the key word. Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson told Congress the global economy would collapse in 24 hours if they didn't act. Federal Reserve Chairman at the time, Ben Bernanke, reportedly came up with the $700 billion figure, but it was pretty much plucked out of thin air. $700 billion isn't based on any particular data point. We just wanted to choose a really large number, said a US Treasury spokeswoman. Yep, that's a real quote from the Treasury back in 2008. It took a couple of votes to make it happen, but the bill eventually passed. $700 billion to rescue Wall Street. That's $4,635 per working American. More than the median life savings of an American household at the time. And this was just the start. Most people think the bailout ended with this $700 billion package. A one-time hit to keep the economy going. But it got worse. So much worse. As Matt Taibbi put it in an infamous Rolling Stone article, we thought we were just letting a friend cash at the house for a few days. We ended up with a family of hillbillies who moved in forever, sleeping nine to a bed and building a meth lab on the front lawn. We didn't bail out the banks once. We gave them a blank check forever. Behind the scenes, the Federal Reserve started lending money to the banks in secret. And when I say lending, I mean printing money. Again, I'm not exaggerating. Here's how Bernanke described it. It's much more akin to printing money than it is to borrowing. The banks have accounts with the Fed, much the same way you have an account at the commercial bank. To lend to a bank, we simply use the computer to mark up the size of the account they have at the Fed. Bernanke printed $7.7 trillion in emergency loans for the banks in just a couple of years, in complete secrecy. That's 10 times more than the original bailout. If people knew this was going on, there would have been riots. It would have made Occupy Wall Street look like a sewing circle. By the way, you should know that Bernanke was obsessed with this concept of printing money before any of this happened back in 2002. He gave a speech where he boasted, "The US government has a technology called a printing press that allows it to produce as many dollars as it wishes at essentially no cost." And he knew exactly what this would do to the dollar. By increasing the number of US dollars in circulation, or even by credibly threatening to do so, the US government can also reduce the value of a dollar in terms of goods and services. "This is a good thing," he said, "because it allows them to achieve inflation." Money printer go brrr. So you shouldn't be surprised to hear what Bernanke and the Federal Reserve did next. Quantitative easing, QE, aka large-scale asset purchases. It's a complicated way of saying money printing. So whenever you hear the words quantitative easing or QE, just think printing money. Here's Harold to explain. Harold is now chairman of the Federal Reserve. In his new role, Harold isn't allowed to literally print new dollar bills and give them out. That would be too suspicious. Instead, he logs onto the Fed's computer and buys billions of dollars worth of government treasury bonds. He buys a few billion dollars worth of those sketchy mortgage-backed security bonds from the banks too. Harold is effectively pumping new money into the system by buying debt. And where does he get the money to buy all these assets? Well, that's where the money printing part comes in. Harold literally just increases the number of dollars on the screen at the Federal Reserve. A couple of clicks. Harold hasn't technically created new dollar bills, but he's increased the total dollar supply and flooded the banks with liquidity. And if Harold's explanation still sounds confusing, here's Congressman Keith Rothfuss grilling Bernanke himself about it. Rothfuss, where does the Fed get the money to buy these assets? Do you create the reserves? Bernanke, yes. Rothfuss, are you printing money? Bernanke, pauses. Not literally. Over the next 4 years, the Fed turned on the tap and increased its balance sheet by more than $3 trillion. So get this. You already paid off for the first bailout with your own taxpayer money, and you're still paying for it now. Every time they print new dollars and devalue your cash savings, the money printer went brrr. The Fed printed trillions of dollars out of thin air to save the banks. And right at the same time, in that obscure corner of the internet, Satoshi Nakamoto created Bitcoin, a new, scarce digital money with a hard supply, slowly ticking away, one block at a time. Banks versus Bitcoin. 21 million Bitcoin versus infinity dollars. Who do you think wins?